So yesterday we looked at five verses, and I think you'd agree with me, they were very beautiful and set the pattern for the whole letter. It focused on Jesus giving himself, and Paul was keen that we see that not just as Jesus giving himself, but revealing God and God's will for us. So this morning it'll be less deep theology than yesterday's, but anyhow, see if you can enjoy it. Chapter 1, verse 6, Paul writes, "I'm astonished that you're so quickly deserting the one who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another gospel, but there are some who are confusing you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ." The Greek word used for confusing there is quite enlightening, I think, tarasso. It means confusing by introducing fear into their relationship with their Messiah, with Christ. And there's a lot of that happens, as you well know, and we can be guilty of it ourselves. So they're introducing fear into a love relationship. Later he'll say, "False believers secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus, so they might enslave us." To this point, Paul has followed the customary form for beginning a letter. One would expect to find here some words of thanksgiving. Instead, we find this abrupt expression of profound concern. It's a measure of Paul's confidence in the affection that's been established between himself and those whom he's writing to, but also of his amazement over what has happened. He feels free to vent so strongly his feelings. Information, obviously, has reached Paul that something's happening in the churches of Galatia. Reaches Antioch, where he is, having returned from Galatia. And it's something that cuts at the very heart of the gospel. Some, perhaps many, we're not told how many, in the churches have been persuaded to embrace ideas and a way of life that are opposed to the gospel which Paul proclaimed while among them, the loving and liberating gospel. Paul wants them to be in no doubt that in doing so they're abandoning God himself, who has called them into communion with the Messiah, and in whose grace they've been living. The Judean missionaries, I'll call them, judged that Paul's failure to insist on the Gentile converts keeping the Jewish Torah was a failure to be faithful to Jesus. However, and I believe this is the key, they continued to fit Jesus into their reading of the scriptures, and they failed to read their scriptures in the light of Jesus. As I was looking at this morning, I'd just pause, you might pause with me just to, this conversion to Jesus is one thing, fitting Jesus into a frame of reference that I've already acquired or that I'm keen on is quite another. I've got two volumes here. I'm not suggesting you read them overnight. And these are the apocryphal writings of the New Testament. There's a lot of them. And I think, I have studied it, but I'm not going to claim too much study, but I have done. I had a conversation when I was in Kippax between a religious sister who'd come visiting for some reason, and she was a feminist, which is all right, but she was a bit aggressive as a feminist, and she was also saying, why are we only having four Gospels? Why don't we have all these other Gospels? And she was expressing a point of view that I've heard a lot, as though somebody in authority, let's say the Pope, in those days, he couldn't do this, but anyhow, the geography didn't allow it, said, oh, you can read these four Gospels, but you can't read these Gospels. Well, that's total rubbish. The reason why the four Gospels we've got, first century documents, why they are still here, is because communities wanted to hear them. Let's look at the letter Paul wrote to the Galatians, say someone in Ephesus. So they read it, and they preach on it, and they treasured it. Other stuff like this, I think, I'm not claiming to know this, but I think it's true, they're written mostly in Egypt, but that's another matter, later, next century or even into the 3rd century, and they're written by groups who are fascinated by Jesus, who hear the gospel preached, and who fit that into their position, rather than convert to Christianity, rather than recognize the limits of their thinking. And this is a very modern problem, isn't it? It's all around us and probably with us. Fitting Jesus in rather than letting go, believing the good news, and repenting, changing our life. So in any case, when I was having this book, she was driving me mad. So I went to my library, picked this up, and read to her the last bit of the Coptic Gospel of James. And this is the final paragraph. And if you can't see why it hasn't been included in the canon, you'll soon see it. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Manahem go out from among us, for women are not worthy of this life." Jesus said, "Look, I lead her that I may make her male, in order that she may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." I thought that would end the argument. Because she had to choose somewhere. It didn't. It just went over. She kept going, so I thought, I've got to leave here. So I excused myself politely, I hope, and left. But it's not uncommon for people to talk like that, or to think that some leader, some religious leader, has forbidden some books, and that's quite typical, and allowed others. No, it's a question of faith recognizing something that nourishes, seeing something that inspires and causes us to change our way of looking, rather than fitting it in somewhere to confirm our position. So back to Galatians, because that's the problem Paul's having. It's unthinkable for these Judean missionaries that any of their sacred traditions, any of their ways of which faithful Jews have expressed their obedience to God and their covenant obligations, and all that's terribly beautiful, it's unthinkable that there could be something that transcended that. They insist, therefore, that Gentiles who wish to share in the blessings of Abraham and the fullness of life as lived by Jesus the Jew must be circumcised. We'll come back to that later in Galatians, and must observe the Jewish feasts. That's also mentioned later in Galatians, and other regulations of the law. Paul saw Jesus as freeing us to live a life of love in the light of what Jesus is and did and said. Whereas these people, and they're Christians, inverted commas, like us, but they haven't got the message. They've come to Galatia as missionaries, confident in the support of a powerful group in the Jerusalem church. How much they represent the Jerusalem church is another matter. Luke tells us of certain individuals who came down to Antioch from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Acts chapter 15, verse 1. He speaks also, that's Luke, of some believers who belonged to the sect of the Pharisees, who proclaimed during a meeting of the community in Jerusalem that, quote, it's necessary for the Gentile converts to be circumcised and ordered to keep the law of Moses. However, at the conclusion of that meeting, which hadn't happened at the time of the writing of this letter, it was probably the next year, but at the conclusion of that meeting, this opinion was not supported. And a letter was sent out from the Jerusalem community to Antioch stating that those, quote, who've gone out from us and have said things to disturb you, and that's Luke using exactly the same verb, tarasso, that Paul used in the earlier verse, they've unsettled your minds. Well, they went with no instructions from us. So lower, people lower.
Is this the Antioch in Galatia, in Pamphylia?
No, this is Syria.
Right.
This is the Antioch Church of Syria, where it's all happening. Yeah. But they had no instructions from the Jerusalem community, though they claimed it. That's another thing we've got to be careful of course. One can imagine the horror of the Judean missionaries from their trained, and not bad, but not aware of what Christianity is, when they came to Galatia and they found the Gentile Christians felt under no obligation to follow the Torah. They're obviously meeting with a good deal of success in convincing the new converts that the gospel given them by Paul is insufficient, and that if they want to be saved, they must obey God's will as expressed in the Torah. If Jesus didn't happen, that's a reasonable point of view. According to the missionaries, it's a matter of obedience to God and fidelity to their part in the covenant with God into which they've been welcomed. So I like to think that they're good people, they're earnest people, they're hurt and they're concerned, but they haven't got the message. This letter is Paul's response to that. He's already touched on the central point by speaking of Jesus, quote, who gave himself for our sins to set us free from the present evil age, according to the will of God, our God and Father. Again and again, Paul will come back to the cross and to Jesus' gift of himself in love. This and this alone is their security. A so-called gospel that requires of Gentile converts that they observe the Jewish law is not good news at all. It's counterfeit. We need not assume that these missionaries were setting out intentionally to pervert the gospel of Christ, Paul's words, but this is what they're doing. Later in the letter, Paul will accuse them of wanting to follow a following themselves, giving them some importance, of avoiding the cross, he'll accuse them, and of wanting to boast about their missionary success. All of this I can do, and I presume you can do, and we can do. We're not looking at what others did 2,000 years ago. This is the danger we all face. He wants to alert the Galatians, and so us, to the fact that if they continue to listen to these intruders, they're abandoning the grace of God offered them in Jesus. Paul goes on in verse 8, even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you or an apparition of a saint somewhere today on a fence or somewhere else, if they preach to you a gospel contrary to what we proclaim to you, let that person be accursed. The Greek word is anathema, and I've just explained the meaning of it here. It's not totally obvious without some explanation. Things were anathema when they were offered to God for God's judgment. In itself, it's not a negative term. It's just, we haven't got part of this. We're not going to handle it. We shouldn't have anything to do with it. Let's leave them with God and God will sort it out. When something is made anathema, others cannot touch it. And Paul, as I understand it, wants the Galatians not to get involved with the Judean missionaries. They'll never beat them in an argument because these people are clued up on the law. And they're not, they're just new. Just don't get involved with them because they leave them to God. But don't take them seriously and don't listen to what they're saying for the reasons Paul has given. They're preaching a pseudo-gospel. As Paul will go on to demonstrate, it's true that Jesus is the fulfillment of the scriptures, yes, but not in the way in which the missionaries are claiming. It's also true that it matters how the Galileans behave. Of course it does. But they mustn't be sensitive to the, they must be sensitive to the guidance. Galileans is wrong, I mean. The Galatians. Pardon me. They must be sensitive to the guidance of Jesus' Spirit, not caught up in fulfilling obligations that have nothing to do either with them as Gentiles or with the following of Jesus. Paul continues, verse 9. As we've said before, I repeat now, he said, if anyone proclaims to you, and remember they're new converts, a gospel contrary to what you've received, let that one be accursed. Am I now seeking human approval? Says Paul, because he's obviously been accused of seeking approval. Or am I looking for God's approval? Or am I trying to please people by being soft on them and not teaching them the Torah and welcoming them into the church in a trivial, kind of nice way, but not getting to the heart of it? If I was still pleasing people, and I think the word still is worth underlining, if I was still pleasing people, I wouldn't be a slave of Christ. Extraordinarily brave word to put in a letter that he's talking precisely about being free from slavery. But he doesn't see himself as a slave of Christ, as taking away freedom. My comment is, it would seem that the missionaries from Judea have persuaded the Galatians that Paul failed to insist on their submitting to the law and so proclaimed a defective gospel because he wanted to ingratiate himself with them by making things easy for them. Paul is sent by God and by the risen Christ. The only approval that interests him is theirs. As he writes elsewhere in the next letter to the Thessalonians, just as we've been approved by God to be entrusted with the message of the gospel, even so we speak, not to please mortal human beings, but to please God who tests our hearts. That word still, if I was still pleasing people, he seems to be admitting that that's how he used to behave when he persecuted Christians to get the approval of the authorities in Jerusalem. He was a young man. He was ambitious. He claims to have been the best of the Pharisees of his own age. And maybe he just got caught up in all that approval. But not now. Now he's a slave of the Messiah. This is a particularly powerful self-description, especially in this letter. Jesus lived a life of self-transcendence through self-giving, love. And he did so in obedience, according to the will of our God and Father. So it must be the same for Paul. The freedom brought by the gospel is not a freedom for self-promotion or self-satisfaction, such as it is encouraged by this present evil age. It's the freedom to obey the gracious will of God and to enjoy the communion in love which comes only from being a prisoner of Christ, as it were, letting him take over our life, captured by love. If any persuasion is needed, Paul's confident that the gospel has its own power. It doesn't need his persuasion. The truth has a power on its own. Just say it, do it, live it, and it'll be convincing to anyone open to it. You know about the called the servant songs in the exilic section of Isaiah's scroll. Well, servant is okay, but the word is always in the Hebrew and in the Greek, slave. That was part of their world, their domestic and social world. And this, so he's using a traditional word. The portrayal of Jesus as God's suffering slave, servant, who's taken up in glory, is central to all of Paul's writings. Here, in his earliest letter, he identifies with the one who suffers in carrying out the mission entrusted to him by the Lord. Verse 11 and 12, Paul goes on, I would have you know, brothers and sisters, that the gospel that was proclaimed by me is not of human origin. I didn't receive it from a human source, nor was I taught it. I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. He'll say to the Corinthians, I handed on to you what I in turn had received. So he did learn from the Christian community. Of course, he learned all about Jesus' public ministry and whatever he wanted to find out about, all the stuff you find in Luke's gospel, because they're very close. And Luke, when Paul's dying, he says, only Luke is with me. So, of course, Paul's not denying that he learned from people. And the distinction I have made, whether it's valuable or not, I'm not sure. Paul knows about Jesus from from other people. He knows Jesus from revelation. And they're not the same. Know in the biblical sense is communion, intimate communion. What you know through intimacy, not information that you've received. When Paul says that he received the gospel through a revelation of Jesus Christ, he's referring to the way in which Jesus revealed himself to him. But he's saying much more than that. He's claiming that Jesus is the one in whom God has revealed God's self and God's will to save. This is the good news. Otherwise, we have a beautiful Jesus and an obscure, angry, controlling God. At least that's a danger. No, this is all Jesus is showing us who the real God is. God isn't locked into the past. As I said yesterday, may I repeat it briefly, the words of Scripture and the words that the wonderful bishops and so on that came up within the councils, they're never, we can always say when something's wrong, clearly, but to say what's right is impossible ultimately. All we can get are words that spark and point to a mystery, but they point in the right direction to stop us going down dead ends. God isn't locked into past words. On the contrary, the gospel of which Paul is an apostle is a new revelation which God has made in Jesus Christ. Maybe it would have been better if I'd said the revelation is that Jesus was open to it. That's the revelation. God has always revealed God. There's nothing else to reveal for God. But who picked it up? Who embraced it? Who knew it? Well, I'm not to say who did or who didn't, but Paul's telling us that Jesus really knew it. So what he shows us is the truth. It's perfecting the law, but not locked into it. It's a new creative act of God. Nothing can be the same anymore. God has revealed love in a surprising and new way. The self-giving of Jesus reveals that communion with God is possible for everyone. And is offered to everyone through union with Jesus. So it's offered to me, not what others want me to be, or what I wish I was, or which I used to be, or dream of being, but me. I'm the one God loves. I, all of us, of course, as we are. Now, love as we are doesn't mean stay as you are. In fact, we can't stay as we are if we're loved. The love changes us, transforms us, as it transformed Paul, picking up his energy, picking up his commitment, picking up his heroism, picking up his strength, picking up all of that, but it's transformed now because he has experienced intimacy of love. Because the offer God is making in Jesus has to be welcomed. Because we're free. It will radically change our lives. But there's no place for attempting to become what we're not. There's an absolute hopeless for a Gentile to become a Jew. That's not what it's about at all. There's no place for a Gentile to behave as though he or she were a Jew. God's grace in Jesus redeems us where we are, and as we are. The gospel proclaimed to the Galatians by Paul has its origin in God, of course, And God has revealed the good news by revealing Jesus the Messiah. To know the true gospel, we don't fit Jesus into our tradition the way the writers of these did. Little sects in Egypt or wherever, in Syria, who had their own view and then thought, oh, Christianity is interesting, we could use that. And they sometimes quote it very well. But it's not the same. Jesus is not... To know the true gospel, we don't fit Jesus into our tradition as though he were a further step along a familiar path. We open ourselves in faith, hope, and love to the action of Jesus' Spirit in our lives, freeing us from all that would limit God as well as from all that would distract us from God, including our human traditions, however sacred. Nothing Paul says indicates that he thinks that a Jewish Christian should cease to be a Jew. Heavens. Christianity is the flowering of Judaism and its fulfillment. But for a group of Jews to come from Judea insisting the Gentiles follow the law is a preposterous enslavement that, in the name of the gospel, Paul cannot countenance. He goes on in verse 13. You've heard, no doubt, of my earlier life in Judaism. I was violently persecuting the Church of God. I was trying to destroy it. I advanced in Judaism beyond many among my people of the same age. I was far more zealous for the traditions of my ancestors. Why is he writing that? He's saying, look, I know what these Judean missionaries are doing. I was one of them. I had the same view. So I'm not kind of talking about what I don't know. He goes on, but when God, who has set me apart before I was born, a quote from the scriptures, and called me through his grace, was pleased to reveal his Son to me and also in me, so that I might proclaim him among the Gentiles. Like them, he acted out of zeal for the law. However, something happened that changed all that, and it was something that God did. Quote, God was pleased to reveal his Son in me and to me. Paul, of course, must have been ready for it. And more importantly, when it happened, he embraced it. Paul experienced a conversion on the road to Damascus. From being determined to keep Judaism pure from Gentile defilement, Paul came to see that fidelity to Judaism means recognizing Jesus as the promised Messiah and welcoming the Gentiles to share in this truth and to form one family with Jews, each person and each culture bringing its own richness to this Catholic universal community. Luke sums up Paul's preaching in Damascus in the Acts when he says, Paul immediately began to proclaim Jesus in the synagogues, saying, he is the Son of God. The word Son is messianic. The only time the word Son is used of a person in the Bible, I've got the three only texts there. 2 Samuel, Psalm and Psalm. It's talking about the king who was adopted as a son at his coronation. The title Son of God, as with all other messianic titles, takes on a special meaning when it's used of Jesus by Christians. It places the focus on the intimate communion in life between Jesus and God, whom he calls Abba. It can take on other meanings in the light of church teaching later, but in the Gospels and in the New Testament, this is the limit of its meaning, as I understand it. He keeps saying God is his Abba. What made the difference to Paul was when he came to see that the God whom he thought he was defending with such zeal had chosen to reveal God's self in Jesus. The other key aspect of Paul's conversion experience was that God was calling him to proclaim this truth about Jesus to the non-Jews, to the Gentiles. Luke was very aware of this, as we see from the three separate accounts that he gives of Paul's initial conversion. I won't delay on them, but I will just note them. And it's interesting to look at the differences. In Luke's first account, Acts chapter 9, Jesus appears to Paul, tells him that it's he, Jesus, whom Paul is persecuting, and this has been picked up by scholars ever since, why didn't Jesus tell Paul what to do? No. He instructed him to go to Damascus and he'd be told there what to do. It's got something to do with spiritual direction, I think, and many other deep things that, as John of the Cross says, God will not reveal something to me unless he also reveals it to a wise person. Well, the wise person in this scene was Ananias. Jesus appears in that first account to Ananias, and he informs Ananias that he's chosen Paul, and what was it? To bring my name before Gentiles and kings and before the people of Israel. I myself will show him, Paul, how much he must suffer for the sake of my name. So that's a summary of the first account. The second one, it's Ananias who explains to Paul, quote, this is Acts chapter 22, the God of our ancestors, Ananias says, has chosen you to know his will, to see the righteous one, and to hear his own voice, for you will be his witness to all the world of what you've seen and heard. And this is followed by a vision which Paul has in the temple of Jerusalem, in which Jesus tells him, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. And in the third account, Ananias isn't mentioned. It's Jesus himself who tells Paul, I'm sending you to the Gentiles. Like Paul, Luke isn't ruling out human mediation. The key point is that the choice of Paul as a missionary to the Gentiles is from God. In verse 12, which we just read, Paul says that he received the gospel through a revelation of Jesus Christ. He makes the same point in verse 16. The gospel is based on something that God has done in choosing to reveal himself and his saving will in Jesus. The basis of Paul's apostolic mission is that God has revealed Jesus to Paul and commissioned him to proclaim the good news to the Gentiles. The choice is God's. The call is God's. The timing is God's. The revelation enlightened his whole soul And he had Christ speaking, he heard Christ speaking within him. Paul came to know Jesus and God's will for him through his experience of the life-giving spirit of the risen Christ, who filled his heart and commissioned him to share this experience among the Gentiles. One reason for Paul focusing on his experience is to invite the Galatians to stop listening to all this pseudo-theology and getting all frightened. No, go back to your own experience. Remember what's happened to you. Remember what happened to you when Barnabas and I spoke to you 6 months ago or whatever. To reflect on what God has done in their lives and not get caught up in arguments with the Judean missionaries. And now back to Paul, verse 16 of the chapter 1. I didn't confer with any human being, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me. I went away, after his conversion, I went away at once into Arabia. I showed you the map earlier, the first time. And afterwards I returned to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I did go up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas, and I remained with him a fortnight. But I didn't see any other apostle except James, the Lord's brother. And in their extended family, it could mean same mother, same father. It could mean half-brother. It could mean a cousin. It could mean anyone on that bitty boy of his contemporaries. So we're not told exactly the relationship. In what I'm writing to you before God, I don't lie. Then, having spent only a fortnight with Cephas and James, in fact, James is the leading presbyter in Jerusalem, I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia. Tarsus is in Cilicia. And I was still unknown by sight to the churches of Judea that are in Christ. All they heard said was this: the one who formerly was persecuting us is now proclaiming the faith he once tried to destroy. And they glorified God because of me. He had very little dealings with them, obviously. Paul has already stated that he was commissioned as an apostle by God himself and by Jesus, and not by the apostles in Jerusalem. He reinforces his point here. How could he have received the gospel from the apostles in Jerusalem? And how could he derive his authority as an apostle from them when he's had so little contact with them? And when he says that he didn't confer with any human being, he's not denying conversations or faith sharing with Ananias, with the other Christians in Damascus. He's stating that whatever conversations he had were not the origin of his gospel. As regards apostles in Jerusalem, it was 3 years before he visited Jerusalem, and then he only stayed a fortnight. Apart from Peter, the leader of the 12, the only other person was James, the brother of the Lord. There's the map again, just to remind you. Paul passes quickly over the 3 years immediately following his conversion. The point he's making is he didn't spend those 3 years in Jerusalem with the apostles. He wasn't part of the community that these Judean missionaries are claiming authorized them to come to Galatia. All he tells us is that he went at once to Arabia and afterwards returned to Damascus. Luke also passes quickly over this period, mentioning briefly Paul's preaching in Damascus and a plot by some Jews to kill him, which forced him to escape through an opening in the wall. Luke's words, the disciples, under cover of darkness, lowered Paul down in a basket. Paul also mentions this incident in the 2 Corinthians. He says, in Damascus, the governor under King Aretas, the Nabataean king, guarded the city of Damascus in order to seize me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands. Luke also mentions Paul's brief visit to Jerusalem and the role played by, this is back in 37 AD, and the role played by Barnabas, who introduced Paul to the apostles and telling them that Paul had seen the Lord who'd spoken to him, and how in Damascus he'd spoken boldly in the name of the Lord. Barnabas' words as written by Luke in Acts 9. In his brief account of this visit, Luke writes, Paul spoke and argued with the Hellenists, but they were attempting to kill him. And when the believers learnt of it, they brought him down to Caesarea, Paul, and sent him off to Tarsus. Luke also mentions the fact that sometime after this, Barnabas was sent down to Antioch from Jerusalem, where they heard that the Gentiles were joining the church in Antioch in great numbers. That's in Acts 11. It was from Antioch, the capital of the Roman province of Syria Cilicia, that Barnabas, quote, went to Tarsus to look for Saul, and when he found him, he brought him to Antioch. So a lot of this is repeating some of the stuff I did on the first day, looking at the history of this. In chapter 2, Galatians, Paul writes, then during these 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I went up in response to a revelation. So he obviously in prayer felt that this was what he should do. The 14 years, I don't know if everyone would agree with this, I think it's the 14 years between his conversion, which was in 34, and the letter to the Galatians, which he's writing in 48. So sometime in that period, after his conversion and prior to writing to the Galatians, he did go with Barnabas and Titus to Jerusalem. Luke also mentions a visit which Paul and Barnabas made to Jerusalem after the visit already noted and before the assembly described in Acts chapter 15, which hasn't happened yet. And this is Luke's words, giving us the setting for that visit. Prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and predicted by the Spirit that there would be a severe famine over all the world. And this took place during the reign of Claudius. The disciples determined, Luke continues, that according to their ability, each would send relief to the believers living in Judea. This they did, sending it to the elders by Barnabas and Saul. So Paul doesn't say so, but Luke tells us the reason for that visit during that extended period was to take provisions and look after the poor Christians. Because as you may know, Judea wasn't self-supporting. The Jews in Judea were always being helped by money coming from overseas, from Jews in the diaspora. When Christianity was cut off from Judaism, and it was the Jews that cut them off, not the Christians, they would have gone along to the synagogue, but they were then excluded, understandably in a way, but that's what happened. Who was going to help? The Jewish Christians. They had no means of support. So here we have an example of Antioch hearing about this, sending some support to the poor Christians of Jerusalem and Judea. Galatians 2, chapter 2. Then I laid before them, though only in private meeting with the acknowledged leaders, the gospel that I proclaimed among the Gentiles, in order to make sure that I was not running or had not run in vain. So Paul isn't hiding what he's doing, he's presenting it to the church in that visit. Even Titus, he says, who was with me, he wasn't compelled to be circumcised, though he was a Greek. But because of false believers secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus, so that they might enslave us, we didn't submit to them even for a moment. Paul would have been a very solid, not a person you'd want to argue with, because he was so brilliant for a start. And he wasn't listening to this group who were undermining, so that the truth of the gospel may always remain for you Gentiles. He's reminding them in the letter of the letter to the Galatians, he's reminding them that he's checked this earlier and it's been a problem for him all through his career. So it's a problem now. Galatians 2:6. From those who were supposed to be acknowledged leaders, brackets, what they actually were doesn't matter to me. God shows no partiality. Those leaders contributed nothing to me. God, on the contrary, when they saw that I'd been entrusted with the gospel for the uncircumcised, just as Peter had been entrusted with the gospel for the circumcised, brackets, for he who worked through Peter, making him an apostle to the circumcised, also worked, and the Greek word is basically a word for energy. He also energized through me in sending me to the Gentiles. And when James and Cephas and John, who were acknowledged pillars, recognized the grace that had been given to me, they gave to Barnabas and me the right hand of fellowship, agreeing that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. Paul's writing, this is not the Council of Jerusalem yet, Paul's writing to them about that meeting and how the leaders approved of what he was doing. So stop trusting these missionaries that are telling you that the leaders have sent them to stop it. Paul is consistent in keeping the focus not on himself or the pillars of the Jerusalem church, whom he respects, obviously, but he's keeping the focus on God. The fact that James, the leader of the presbyters who governed the Jerusalem church, Cephas, the leader of the 12, and John, another of the 12, agreed with Paul was significant. And Paul wants the Galatians to know about it. However, he's not appealing to their authority, nor is he impressed with the way others speak of them. God, says Paul, shows no partiality. God doesn't arbitrarily favour some and not others. God doesn't say that European culture is better than the culture in Ecuador or whatever, Spain and Ecuador. that's not what all the Aborigines or culture stuff. Anyhow, God shows no partiality. Those whom the Jerusalem community look up to as their leaders are to be judged, like Paul himself, by their fidelity to the mission given them by God. What matters is what Paul wrote in those verses, is the truth of the gospel. It's God who's working through Peter. It's God who's working through Paul. The agreement was reached because they looked at what was happening and saw God at work. God chose Peter to be apostle to the Jews, and it's God who sent Paul to the Gentiles. It would be against the whole tenor of this passage to see these two categories as mutually exclusive, as though they were two separate churches. Such a conclusion would ignore what we know from Luke about Peter and the acceptance of Cornelius, Acts chapter 10. It would also ignore what Luke tells us about Paul's missionary strategy. He always went first to the Jews. The result of this meeting was that the leaders of the Jerusalem church accepted the practice of the church in Antioch of welcoming Gentiles without their having to be circumcised. It's important to note that unlike the Jerusalem assembly, which is still in the future, I believe, as Paul is writing, nothing was said at this private meeting about laws governing eating. That will emerge as a problem later.